Hello and welcome to Thinking Out Loud on KBIA. The Kinder Institute at the University of Missouri recently welcomed Johann Niem, a renowned scholar and writer, on the topic of public education in the United States. And we spoke to Dr. Niem about public schools and, in particular, the history of public education in the United States from the Revolution to the Civil War era and how the attitudes from our founders set a cornerstone that exists today in attitudes in our society about educational opportunity for all young Americans. We talk with Johann Niem about his book, Democracy's Schools, The Rise of Public Education in America, tonight on Thinking Out Loud from KBIA. It's Thinking Out Loud from KBIA. I'm Darren Helwedge. Tonight's guest is Johann Niem. He was a recent visitor to our school, gave an address from the Kinder Center on Constitutional Democracy. He is a senior fellow at the University of Virginia's Institute for Advanced Studies and a professor of history at Western Washington University and has written a book called Democracy Schools, The Rise of Public Education in America. It's available on Johns Hopkins Press. And Johann, welcome. Good to have you with us this evening.
Thank you for having me here.
Absolutely. We're going to talk a lot about the book and sort of what I found in looking through it, it's about primarily the history of public education, but there's so much I found that kind of ties in with the modern day politics and conversations that we're having about public education. Before we get into that, because there's some big stuff here and some big thinkers and founding fathers and all of that jazz, the book begins with an introduction that kind of tells your own personal story and why public education is important to you. And talk a little bit about that.
Sure. So I was born in India and came to the United States to the San Francisco suburbs when I was a small child and attended public schools from kindergarten through high school. And this was a time where the Bay Area was quite a diverse place and becoming more diverse. And the schools brought us together. And one of the amazing experiences about those schools was that they opened up American history and culture to all of us. And so it was not, it didn't belong to anyone. You had the sense that the whole story belongs to all of us.
And we're going to talk a good deal more about that kind of being a goal of public education from the beginning. I'm going to quote a couple of different times things that I read in this that I found very interesting. And talking about the early American history, not necessarily the history of public education, but just the history of our nation.
Sure.
And Benjamin Franklin being asked about the new government. He's got the ink still drying on this new constitution. And I love this line. They asked him what kind of government it was. And he said, a republic if you can keep it. And that wasn't something that should be taken for granted. We had seen republics fall many times before. And the quote is kind of an understanding even then that democracy requires informed citizens.
That's absolutely right. I think we forget sometimes just how fragile democracies are. And for Franklin, he supposedly said, a republic if you can keep it. And there was real concern. There was a lot of, you know, Rome had famously fallen, and Athenian democracy had been quite brief, and there had been a small experiment in England that led to the tyranny under Cromwell. There were a lot of reasons to fear that if the people and their leaders were not educated, capable, and ethical, that and didn't care for the good of the republic, that this experiment would fail. And so with all the optimism our founders had, that optimism was combined with a lot of fear and anxiety about what they were undertaking.
In the time we're talking about, late 1700s, how revolutionary was the idea of providing a quality education or the opportunity for one at least to everybody? Because obviously there were great schools and great thinkers and very well-educated people in Greece and Rome and certainly in England, but it wasn't everybody. It was the elite few.
That's right. I mean, I think there's two answers to that. One is both in Europe and in the United States, there had been in the 19th century a push to expand education as governments sought to develop the capacities of their nations. The Americans started earlier and in many ways were ahead of the game. And part of the reason was this real commitment to ensuring that if we are going to enfranchise our citizens, we want to be sure that they have the knowledge and skills to participate effectively in public life. And that was a really, you know, it's hard to overstate how important education was to those first generations as a bulwark for American liberty. And they, whether or not it can support that is a separate question, but from their eyes, it was essential.
Sure. Johan Niem is our guest. The book, again, is titled Democracy Schools, The Rise of Public Education in America. And a good part of the conversation that we're going to want to have with Johan today is about a fairly simple yet very important part of the book, in which you talk about the title, Democracy Schools, and four ways in which public education really was seen in the early days of public schools and is seen, I suppose, still today, or at least the goal is, as promoting democracy, as being a part of the cornerstone of our democracy. The first is that they be local in organization. And that's still the case for the most part. Funding pretty much comes either from the local community, property taxes in our case for a large part, or from the state, not nearly so much from the feds. A lot of curriculum decisions are made community to community and even building to building. And why is that important?
Well, I think it's important in several ways. One of the most important reasons is that it ensures that the way we socialize the next generation is not determined solely by people very distant from the communities, that citizens, not just parents, but citizens within a community have a voice and a say in the content of the school curriculum. I think practically it was really important because it gave local communities a stake in the success of their schools through self-government. And so one of the things we're seeing is that schools become more distant from local communities. They also struggle to retain the support of those communities. But I think that we shouldn't forget there is a tension. Education reformers often had a vision and knowledge that citizens lacked. And so local control was a virtue, but it was always existing within a context where reformers and educated elites were trying to often do good things, and sometimes with the support of and sometimes at odds with what localities wanted. And so that's a tension that goes through our history of education.
Sure. I ran for Board of Education here in Columbia about 20 years ago, and about every 10 or 12 doors I would knock on, somebody wanted to talk about outcomes-based education, and that's a term we don't hear much any longer, but it was a thing back then. Nowadays, it would probably be Common Core or New Math, which has not been new for decades, but it's still something that people talk about. And sometimes it was people that had just heard the phrases, and it for them indicated Washington bureaucrats, and they didn't really understand the issue very much. Sometimes it was people that were genuinely well-informed and just didn't necessarily agree with the idea of, as you say, the educated elite. And it's easy, again, to point at one city and say people from Washington, D.C. shouldn't decide how my kid in Columbia, my kid in a small town in Mississippi, my kid in San Francisco should be educated.
I think that's right. And I think if I were to come down, I would say we need a balance. And each side provides, in some ways, some kind of countervailing check on the other. But I do think if schools were ever, I do think if local communities and citizens were no longer participants in the governance of their schools and making real meaningful decisions about their schools, we would lose something important to our democracy.
Yeah, getting that buy-in and participation, not just from the parents, although certainly from the parents, but the community at large. Johan Niem is our guest. He, again, was a recent visitor to campus from the Kinder Institute on Constitutional Democracy. Their website is democracy.missouri.edu, and they have a schedule of a lot of other interesting events and speakers that are coming to the Mizzou campus in the weeks and months to come. The second of the four ways that public education is about democracy schools, promoting curriculum that was designed to prepare students for, and this is a direct quote, citizenship and self-culture. First of all, talk about self-culture. What a fascinating concept that is.
Yes. I think this was one of the great, you know, surprises to me was – I think we know at some level that the founding generations cared a lot about the civic purposes of schools, even if sometimes we forget that in our own conversations today. But they cared also about developing the capacities of the boys and girls in those schools. They wanted to develop the faculties of reason and imagination, as they would have described it. They wanted to offer every student a liberal education to allow, enable them to see the richness that the arts and sciences, history, literature, chemistry, math, and physics had to give them insight into the world. And they thought that that kind of rich education would be fertilizing. It was not only important because it would provide citizens the kinds of knowledge they needed to make thoughtful decisions about the world, but it would provide a kind of inspiration for people to go out and engage in making new worlds. This is the age of the self-made man, and to make a self, surprisingly, for people in this period, did not mean simply pulling yourself up by your bootstraps. It meant investing in public institutions like schools so that people had their capabilities developed and went out in the world able and ready and excited to do new things with their lives.
My dad was a chemistry professor, and so he dealt very much with rationality and facts that could be checked and confirmed or disproven or whatever, but he always talked a lot about intellectual curiosity. He liked seeing young people with intellectual curiosity, not just knowing the facts, but having whatever it is inside you that makes you want to learn more things, want to discover new things, and accept the way I thought this was, I'm looking at the evidence and it's not true. And that's a hard thing for people to do sometimes, isn't it?
Well, that has been the challenge all along, is that this is a great ideal, but schools, I have a chapter on the experiences of teachers and students. Schools are not always intellectually stimulating places.
Yeah.
And students have a lot of pressures on them, and so to achieve this goal of inspiring the intellect and the imagination is something that's still a work in progress, but I'm not sure that we talk about it much anymore. So I don't know that we're still committed to that goal. But it was very important to the reformers who pushed for free public schools in the pre-Civil War period.
The third is interesting also. Disagreements over public schools are part of democratic politics, small d, democratic. And just about everything we could have a political discussion or argument over has something to do with education, taxes and money, dealing with diversity, and we'll get more into that in the fourth one, discipline and violence, art, sports, everything that is a part of this is stuff that schools have to deal with. And the democratic politics, I mentioned to you when we were coming in that there's a school board election in just a few weeks, and that's where a lot of this happens. It's just very local grassroots politics.
I think that's right. I think, you know, one of the things that's hard for those of us who have strong ideals about what makes a good education is to realize that in a democracy, those decisions have to be widely shared by citizens and policymakers, and that there is a tension, I say, between some of the ideals of democratic education that, for example, a particular exposure to the arts and sciences and sometimes what parents want. And the result, I think, is a good one, which is that education in a democracy is subject to the deliberation and decision-making of the citizenry either directly or mediated through their elected leaders. And because education is so important, because it is about our kids, but also because it's about the future of the nation, it's about values, it's about our economic prospects, I think that citizens rightly have a stake in it. And I think that it's important for all of us involved in education to remember that that's ultimately where authority lies.
I want to share my favorite moment from the time I ran for school board. And again, this was over 20 years ago. And we have what's called an alternative school in Columbia, Douglas High School. And I met with the principal there, and I regret very much that I can't remember his name. It's not the current principal. This was some years ago. And I came in with just a snootful. I thought I knew so much. My parents were both educators. My mom's degree was in early childhood ed, and I knew it all. And I came in spouting whatever grand idea was on the top of my mind. And this principal would say, yeah, that's a really good idea for a lot of kids. Yeah, that's a really good idea for most of these kids. And the whole thing that his school was about was that there are some that doesn't work for. And so we either find another way or we lose them. And that was an educational moment for me, certainly, and one I very much remember. The fourth one, the needs of broader society versus the rights of, you mentioned, religious minorities and other minorities. You're talking about race. You're talking about poverty, disabilities, how LGBT people are viewed. That this stuff has really evolved and continues to evolve from just generation to generation.
That's right. I think one of the purposes of the public schools in the period between the Revolution and Civil War was to create a common culture. And democracies, more than other forms of government, require citizens to share a common culture because we need to trust each other. We need to work with each other. We need to have some common ground to work from. In a diverse democracy, perhaps that's even more important. So this is an ongoing struggle. There's no silver bullet that says, how do you balance diversity against common culture? But it's a struggle that's been with us from the beginning, and I think we still, I mean, I think one of the challenges we're facing today from people on the left and right is a loss of faith that the schools have that job, you know, and whether it's expressed through the idea that families should choose the school that conforms to their values or their religion, or sometimes from the left that people from other cultures should not be assimilated into American culture. The challenge we face, and it's very similar to the antebellum period, is that when you have increasing diversity and economic inequality, how do you bring people together as well and do it in a way that still respects people's constitutional rights and the diversity we value? And we're going to struggle with that forever. It's a democratic struggle, but it's a necessary democratic struggle.
It was different groups that we were talking about, but you talk about some of that and maintaining some of the culture of people who were Catholics, people who were German immigrants, and they wanted to hold on to some of their culture while still becoming Americans, and that became a difficult issue. Johan Niem, our guest, Democracy Schools, The Rise of Public Education in America, the book we're discussing. There was, again, a conversation about an earlier era that ties in very closely with what we see these days, the ideas of there being free schools and then there being academies, and how much public money should go to an academy that was exclusive in the way it accepted students, that didn't have Catholic students, that taught religion, et cetera, et cetera. It sounds very much like the discussions people are having right now about school choice.
I think that's right. It's not exactly the same, because one of the big and important successes of reformers and Americans in the period between Revolution and Civil War was to make clear that in our democracy, education is a public good. So in some ways, the question we're facing is how to deliver that public good. The academies of the 19th century were private chartered schools. So in some ways, they can be seen as predecessors to arguments for charter schools today. And I think there are probably multiple ways to organize the delivery of a public education, but one of the secrets to the success of 19th century reformers was that by creating institutions with mass participation, you also created mass support. And so one of the questions that I would say we should ask ourselves very seriously is, if we were to move to a less common system, in addition to questions about how we would this exacerbate or help deal with our questions of diversity, is what would this mean for the widespread support we have to tax each other to provide public education? Horace Mann and others knew that the way to make it happen would be to have rich, middle class, and poor parents all invested in the schools and in the same schools, so that they were willing to pay dollars to support the education of other people's children. And that was not true at the time of the Revolution, and it was something that was true by the time of the Civil War.
And then we get to a fascinating conversation, and it was interesting for me. It was kind of fun for me to see some of the things that we take for granted now and in kind of their opening steps. Boylston, Massachusetts, 1829, and they decide that they're going to allocate public dollars based on enrollment and not on how much money the district contributed. And in our state, we have areas of exceptional poverty, and then we have areas like Columbia that's relatively well-to-do, and then we have suburbs of St. Louis or Kansas City, the Pleasant Hill, Ladue, town and country, where there's a whole lot of wealth. And this is saying that the schools ought to be relatively equal, whether you're growing up in Iron County or you're growing up in suburban St. Louis.
Yeah, this is one of the struggles we have, where the virtues of local control come into tension with the fact that many Americans don't really want to go to school with each other. And we have self-segregated, not just by race, but by wealth. And that's a real challenge for American democratic schooling. And we've been struggling with that, and we know we're struggling with that. And it's not clear how best to achieve the egalitarian goals of schooling when, and I'm not blaming parents, I'm a parent, when the desire to get your kid into a so-called successful school is so great that if you have the means, you make use of them. And that often means choosing your district school, moving to the right district, supposedly.
Yes. Yeah. I have known people that I think most of us, if we have children, that's one of the things you're going to look at when you're buying a house is which school district am I in? I like my kids to go to Hickman because of this reason. I like my kids to go to Battle because of this reason, or Rockbridge, the different high schools here in Columbia. And I served for a short time on a subcommittee for the school board that was helping redraw the lines for the grade schools. And man, that's a minefield trying to walk through, you know, taking people from the school that their big brother went to, putting them in a school that's got a different percentage of this type person or that person or what. That's always a very difficult discussion. Johann Niem is our guest. Again, it's Democracy Schools, The Rise of Public Education in America. He was a recent guest on campus from the Kinder Institute on Constitutional Democracy. Again, their website is democracy.missouri.edu. The book is written about history and about this specific time in how public education was formed, but it certainly seemed to me to be written in a way where we could see parallels with the conversations about public education that are going on right now. I'm interested in what you think some of these early people that we're talking about, Horace Mann, for example, might have thought about some of the big changes we've seen in the last century in public education, conversations about school prayer. Obviously, 150 years ago, nobody probably even thought about the fact that the teacher was going to get up and start the day with the Lord's Prayer. I'm only 52, and I remember a first grade teacher who read the Lord's Prayer every day. Brown versus Board in the 50s, IDEA, the Individuals with Disabilities Education Act, which has changed education so much since it came into being. How did the foundation that we've got from the time you're talking about get us to where we are now and dealing with some of these big changes?
That's a fair question. And I think you know, in many ways, part of what I want to show is that we always argued over these issues. And school prayer was an issue in the pre-Civil War period, particularly as increasing numbers of Catholic migrants came to the United States. And it was discussed. And they embraced an ideal called non-sectarianism. But it was, you know, effectively a kind of bland Protestantism. And Catholics, in response, created a separate school system. Today, we're experiencing that from the side of Protestants, conservative Protestants who don't feel welcome to the schools because the schools have, in their effort to be more welcoming to Catholics and Jews and others, taken God out. And our constitutional prohibitions on religion are much stricter today than they were in the past. What's interesting is there's a big gap between the Civil War and today. And many of our, you know, school prayer, In God We Trust, many of these things have long pedigrees, but they're also pretty recent. That school prayer and Bible reading really took off after World War II as a way of contrasting Americans with godless communism. And it was in that context, when that context met the Civil Rights Revolution, that we started to move towards more secular schools. And we alienated a lot of Americans in that process. So I think it's an ongoing project. Now we have to figure out, did we, A, go too far? Is the response that we're so diverse that we need to be able to choose our schools, as our current Secretary of Education suggests? Or are there ways in which the schools can now be more welcoming to those who feel unwelcome? This is an ongoing process. It's part of living in a democracy that's diverse. I think, you know, that there are many people who could read this book and say, you know, the schools have become too bureaucratic, too top down. On the other hand, Horace Mann and others were trying desperately to try to centralize some controls so that they could improve school quality, professionalize the teaching force. And in many ways, they would, I think, fear that those achievements are at risk. But again, other Americans at the time would say we had been fighting this all along. I mean, this is why education is so political. And I don't think that's necessarily a bad thing.
Obviously, if you have kids in schools, it's something that affects your day-to-day life, but certainly for all of us affects particularly the future of our communities, of our state, of our country. And so it is a very important topic and one that is discussed with a lot of very interesting thoughts. Democracy, Schools, The Rise of Public Education in America. Again, it's on Johns Hopkins Press out of Baltimore, and you can check that out if you would like to. And again, Johan Niem, the gentleman we've been speaking with for the last half hour, was on campus recently from the Kinder Institute on Constitutional Democracy, and their future schedule is at democracy.missouri.edu. We wish you safe travels, and thank you very much for the time. It was great to talk to you.
Thank you for having me here.
And our thanks once again to Professor Niem. Thanks also to our friends at the Kinder Institute for Constitutional Democracy here at the University of Missouri for their assistance in putting this week's program together. Remember, you can hear past shows in the Thinking Out Loud series. Just go to kbia.org and click on Programs for Thinking Out Loud. We'll be back next Tuesday with another Thinking Out Loud on KBIA. Till then, I'm Darren Helwedge. Have a great evening.